Hi, it's the show on KJZZ. I'm Steve Goldstein.
And I'm Mark Brody, and this is our podcast version of the program. The show is one of our original productions. It's a curated program of news and features from Phoenix and the state, along with national and international stories.
You can also find segments and additional information at theshow.kjzz.org.
Thanks for listening to the podcast.
Good afternoon. It's the show on KJZZ with Mark Brody. I'm Steve Goldstein. Valley weather for the rest of today. It'll stay sunny and warm. Big shock there. We're looking for a high temperature around 87. And then for tonight, clear skies with lows in the mid to upper 50s. For tomorrow, partly cloudy with a high near 90. And it will cool off quite a bit with breezy conditions on Saturday and a high of 74. Currently under sunny skies and with relative humidity at 11%, it's 81 degrees.
Supporters of the LGBT community in Phoenix are calling on Councilman Michael Nowakowski to resign in the wake of comments that have gone viral disparaging same-sex marriage and the LGBT community. KJZZ's Will Stone has been covering this, and he joins me. Hi, Will.
Hey, Mark.
So what are these groups saying?
They're pretty much saying that for years, Councilman Michael Nowakowski, who is a Democrat, has misled them into believing that he supported LGBTQ issues, LGBTQ rights, but behind closed doors, in front of certain audiences, in this case, in front of a more religious conservative room, he actually said comments that would indicate otherwise.
Will, what are the groups themselves saying that they're hearing from members of the community?
Well, Mark, at the press conference today, there were representatives from really all sorts of different areas of the community. We had other elected officials, Democrats, leaders of various LGBT rights organizations in the Valley, and some constituents, and all of them pretty much saying, since this video has surfaced, they've received even some threats and other kinds of hatred that's been directed toward them. Justin Owen, who directs the Pride Center in downtown Phoenix, discussed that.
In the simple time since the councilman made this statement and this video went public, the amount of hatred that we've received even within this facility through phone calls and through action shows that his words are not excusable. You can't apologize. You have bred hate.
That was Justin Owen, who directs the Pride Center in downtown Phoenix. Will, what has been Councilman Nowakowski's reaction to all of this?
Councilman Nowakowski has not been available for interviews, but he did release a statement and a video late yesterday, pretty much saying he apologized and that his comments were taken out of context. Specifically, what he said in the video was, quote, "I never thought I'd see the day that men would marry men or that people are allowed in the same bathroom as my daughter," unquote. And then he went on to say, "The world is changing and we need to bring it back to the way it should be." And this was being translated into Spanish for him in the video. In response, Councilman Nowakowski came out and said this.
"My reference in the video to return to the way it should be was in regards to prayer at city council meetings, not to roll back the LGBTQ rights. I understand why my statement in the video was misconstrued, and I apologize."
And to be clear, Mark, what the councilman is talking about there is that in the context of that video, he was discussing the issue of getting rid of public prayer at Phoenix City Council meetings, which was a big controversy recently. And it was in that conversation that he brought up these issues, these transgender issues and these LGBT rights issues. He claims that when he said bring the world back to the way it should be, he was talking about public prayer. That explanation doesn't seem to be enough for representatives of the LGBT community in Phoenix, who are all now seem to be calling for his resignation.
That's KJZZ's Will Stone. Will, thank you.
Thanks, Mark.
The Flagstaff City Council says it needs more time to settle a lawsuit with the Hopi tribe over the use of reclaimed wastewater on a mountain the Hopi and a dozen other tribes consider sacred. The Hopi claim the city's decision to sell treated wastewater to a ski resort causes a, quote, public nuisance. From KJZZ's Fronteras desk in Flagstaff, Laurel Morales reports.
After a year of negotiations, the Hopi tribe and city officials came up with a solution. The city would build a $1.6 million earthen filtration system for the already treated wastewater headed to Arizona Snow Bowl. The city's general fund would cover most of the project. The ski resort would pay part of the maintenance costs. The Hopi Tribal Council has unanimously approved the deal. Flagstaff's outside counsel Lee Story said instead of a long court battle, the two parties chose to come up with this agreement.
And we spent countless hours looking at options with our consultants, with Hopi consultants, on what might make sense and would be doable in keeping with the contract and the obligations that the city has with Snow Bowl, which are real and valid.
The ski resort has used the treated wastewater to make snow for 4 years and has stayed open for an extended season as a result. City officials would not say whether the system would filter out so-called compounds of emerging concern. Studies conducted on Flagstaff's treated wastewater show it contains trace levels of endocrine-disrupting chemicals, including hormones, antibiotics, and pharmaceuticals. Toxicologists have found these compounds to be harmful to animals, but they are unregulated.
Basically, you're admitting there's a problem with the water, but you're not setting a standard for the treatment. You're doing the minimal that you need to, as required by a settlement.
Navajo activist Clee Benally reminded the city council they are complicit to the desecration of a sacred site. And he said the city will likely face more lawsuits.
Don't just think about the ramifications of the lawsuits. Think of the impacts for our people. Thank you.
Flagstaff council members expressed concern about the other 12 tribes that were not part of the negotiations. Others were worried about the costs of the filtration system. And the city wants to resolve its suit with Snow Bowl over attorney's fees and damages. So the settlement is on hold until there are more answers than questions. Laurel Morales, KJZZ News, Flagstaff.
Arizona House Speaker David Gowan has asked the state attorney general to investigate his travel expenses. The issue arose after reporting done by Arizona Capital Times found a sharp rise in the use of and miles on state vehicles since Gowan became speaker. Hank Stevenson covers the House for the paper and has been doing the digging on this. He joins me. Hank, what were you initially looking into?
So I pulled a couple of years' worth of records on the state fleet vehicle use. The state maintains a fleet of cars that lawmakers or any state employee can take out, but there are very specific rules on what you can and cannot use those cars for. You can't use them for personal business, essentially. And the records show very clearly that David Gowan and that his sergeant-at-arms, a man named Billy Cloud, a longtime friend of David Gowan's, were using these cars just a very large amount of miles put on these cars.
And you also found that some of these trips appeared at least to be going to campaign events.
Yeah, certainly appeared to be campaign events. You know, he was using these cars a lot to go to Flagstaff, Sedona. This is a lawmaker who's from Sierra Vista, and suddenly went about the time he entered the race for CD1, was spending a whole lot of time traveling CD1, especially in these state vehicles. Some of the events were listed on his calendar as meeting with voters. And really, if you look at his social media page, his Twitter, his Facebook during that time, it was very clear that he was campaigning for votes. The hashtags he used were all AZ01 or Respect the West, which is kind of his campaign slogan that he's been using on the congressional campaign trail. And just the sheer number of trips he was taking to northern Arizona, northeastern Arizona, was very telling for a speaker who hadn't spent a whole lot of time there in the past and a guy who's from the very southern portion of the state.
So what did Speaker Gowan have to say about that apparent discrepancy?
Well, basically his staff said that he's the speaker of the entire state, so he spends a lot of time on the road, and that all those trips were backed up by legitimate business purposes, not necessarily saying that every stop on every trip that he took in a state car was purely state business, but also didn't cop to the fact that they were campaign events. They've always denied that he did any campaigning while driving a state car. But I think if you look at the records, it's hard to come to any other conclusion that at least some of these spots that he stopped at were for his CD1 campaign.
And in fact, Speaker Gowan has reimbursed the state some $12,000 And he's also asked the Attorney General's office to look into these allegations, presumably to clear his name. But as a spokeswoman for the AG's office said, we're going to investigate this, and it might not turn out that way.
Yeah, there's always the possibility. You know, it's a very interesting move. I don't think any of us have ever seen a sitting lawmaker call for the Attorney General to investigate him. But I think, you know, it's a savvy move on his part. Get out in front of this thing. There's a very good likelihood that there was going to be a complaint by an attorney calling for an Attorney General investigation. And, you know, the Attorney General never confirms nor denies whether they have an ongoing investigation. So it's also possible that there could already be an investigation into Gowan.
Other than the possibility of Speaker Gowan's name being cleared and him being exonerated, what are the other possible outcomes from an investigation, assuming the AG's office does one?
Well, it's interesting. I mean, it's very clear that Gowan did something wrong. The very fact that he repaid the state $12,000 is very telling that, you know, something went wrong here. His contention has been that, oh, my staff filled out my per diem and mileage reimbursement reports, and I didn't know that they were claiming these miles while I was also driving a state fleet vehicle. But misusing a state fleet vehicle is a misdemeanor. There's also the issue of misusing public resources for a campaign, which is a bigger deal than just misusing the state fleet vehicles in themselves. So there could be criminal violations depending on, you know, how deep the Attorney General goes on this and what they find.
Hank Stevenson covers the State House of Representatives for Arizona Capital Times. He's been doing the reporting on House Speaker David Gowan and his trips and reimbursements. Hank, thank you very much.
Thanks for having me on.
Yesterday, Governor Doug Ducey signed a bill into law that would ban so-called ballot harvesting. The legislation is intended to prevent individuals or civic and political groups from collecting ballots and turning them in for other people. Supporters say it'll help prevent fraud, but opponents think it's unfair, especially to rural voters. Rick Hassan is a law professor at the University of California, Irvine, and runs electionlawblog.org. Rick, how much do concerns about voter fraud focus on absentee ballots?
They do tend to center around absentee ballots. So fraud is very rare. When it does occur, it tends to occur with absentee ballots. Sometimes it involves the sale of absentee ballots. Sometimes it involves absentee ballots being collected and not turned in. These are rare, but it's much more common than, say, impersonation fraud, which is the supposed reason for laws that require proof of identity at the polling place, which we know is basically non-existent. That really does not happen. So this is a real concern with absentee ballots. But across the country, we see very different patterns. In some places, absentee ballots or mail-in voting works really without a problem. I'd point to the Pacific Northwest, where we have states that have moved to all mail-in balloting, and there doesn't seem to be much of a problem. Yet there are parts of South Texas, parts of Appalachia, areas in Georgia, where we have seen a long history of election fraud occurring with absentee ballots. So it really is a kind of area-specific type of issue.
And when it comes to individual states and their legislatures, does this depend upon which party may or may not be in power? I think there's the stereotype, and maybe an accurate one, that conservative Republicans tend to talk more about voter fraud, and those on the left tend to talk about voter suppression. Is either one a significant problem at this point?
Well, I do think you're right that what we have seen is what I term the emergence of red state and blue state election law, where states with Democratic legislatures are passing laws that make it easier to register and vote. States with Republican legislatures are passing laws that make it harder to register and vote. And this tends to line up with the interests of the parties. The thinking is that those people who would be most affected by laws that make it harder to vote are people that would tend to vote Democratic. And so that this, I think, is why we see these issues. There is a minor problem with voter fraud in some parts of the country, as I've mentioned. Most of the laws that are passed don't seem to be addressing that. There's also problems with voter suppression in the sense that there are places where it's become harder to vote for no good reason. I think also Democrats tend to exaggerate the extent to which these laws have that effect, even if that is their intent. So there's a lot of rhetoric that gets thrown around. I don't want to claim that there's any kind of false equivalence here. I do think that it's better to have people vote so long as we have safeguards. But I do think that there's a lot of political exaggeration on all sides in these debates.
Is this a case where voters have to be paying tremendous attention to have any kind of impact on this, or that people have to get them revved up? Is this an issue that can be a little bit dense for voters who just have a lot of other things going on in their lives?
Well, sure, and I think it's also a little difficult when the term is ballot harvesting. That doesn't sound like something anybody would like. It sounds like organ harvesting. It does not sound like something very pleasant. But I do think that the possibility of political action is there. Look, you know, your state is very polarized right now. It's not just about the absentee ballots. There's fights about whether there's going to be adequate disclosure of campaign money. As you know, the Arizona Proposition 200 has already made its way to the U.S. Supreme Court on issues of proof of identity for voting. And so things are very contentious there, and it would not surprise me to see those on the left who are unhappy with this action of the Republican legislature trying to organize for political action and make a change to the law.
Professor Rick Hassan of the University of California at Irvine. He's also the man behind electionlawblog.org. Professor, thank you.
Thank you.
In November of 2014, about 80% of Arizona voters approved the so-called Right to Try ballot initiative. The goal is to give terminally ill patients the chance to try experimental drugs that hadn't been given the go-ahead by the Food and Drug Administration. Some opponents of the measure said it wasn't needed because of a federal program called Compassionate Use. But in a new investigative report called Dead on Arrival, Mark Flatten of the Goldwater Institute found that compassionate use is a very limited option. The Goldwater Institute was strongly behind the efforts to pass Right to Try in Arizona and other states. Mark, your report says compassionate use is approved in more than 99% of cases, so what's the problem?
If you look at the way the system is built and the way it operates, it literally is designed to fail. It is a system that is completely rigged with negative incentives, disincentives, all kinds of reasons not to participate in compassionate use, and there's absolutely no positive incentives. So if you're a patient, if you're a doctor, if you're a drug company, it's all risk and no reward. It is completely dysfunctional. And the best evidence of that is the numbers themselves. This year, roughly 600,000 people in the United States will die of cancer alone. Every year, the FDA approves about 1,200 requests for compassionate use because the system is completely unnavigable.
Can an individual, without working through a drug company, without working through a doctor, can a person actually apply for compassionate use on his or her own?
No, you cannot apply directly. The first thing you need to do is figure out that the medication exists. Yeah. Once you do that, you've got to convince your doctor to essentially sponsor your application. And for a doctor to do that, they're going to have to commit to spending about 100 hours or more just to compile the information, gather the documents, write a treatment plan, write a monitoring plan, fill out the application form, all of that. And then if it is ultimately approved, the doctor is going to have to agree to provide that treatment for you, which can be a very costly and time-consuming process. So that's just the doctor's perspective. You also have to get the drug company to approve the use of that drug. The way these drugs are approved and eventually marketed is they got to go through these things called clinical trials, where the drug is tested on patients. There's multiple phases. And failure at any stage not only means that drug is probably dead, but it probably also means the drug company is dead too, because most of these innovative new cures are not being developed by the Mercks and the Pfizers. They're being developed by smaller drug companies. A few scientists, maybe a venture capitalist that get together with a new miracle cure. Everything they have is riding on success in those clinical trials. And the problem is if you are a drug company and agree to make your product available, there's no upside. If the patient does well and survives, makes a miraculous recovery, there's absolutely no benefit to you in clinical trials. However, if something bad happens, if the patient dies, an already terminal patient dies, right, that is counted against you in clinical trials.
What about improving the system incrementally? Is there any chance for something like that? Is there reason to think that if there was actually a push for it, you could make the system at least better?
Well, there's no question you can make the system better, but that doesn't necessarily help the people that are looking at 6 months before they die. Mm-hmm. I mean, they literally are trying to save their lives. They're not out there looking for snake oil. They're looking for products that have been tested in clinical trials to show they're at least safe. That have some very good promise of being better than existing treatments.
What did the FDA say to you?
Their main talking point is, look, we approved 99.5% of the applications we receive. It's essentially saying, you know, every application that reaches the top of Mount Everest, we will approve. I mean, that's literally what one drug company executive told us. They say, well, we came out in February of last year, we published a new shorter form that's going to make it easier for doctors to apply for compassionate use. What they don't tell you is, A, yes, they did propose that in February 2015. Here we are in, March of 2016. Mm-hmm. It still has not been approved. Now, they claim it's going to take 45 minutes to fill out this application form. But what that seems to be based on is the time it takes to sit down and fill out the form itself. But to fill out the form, you've got to write treatment plans. You've got to get proprietary, chemical breakdowns of the drug itself. I liken it to filling out your taxes. For most Americans, it takes about an hour to sit down and fill out your taxes. It might take days to compile the information you need to fill out your taxes.
Mark Flatton is national investigative reporter for the Goldwater Institute. We've been talking about his new report, Dead on Arrival, about compassionate use and right to try. Mark, thanks.
Thank you very much.
The recent standoff at a federal wildlife refuge in Oregon highlighted the debate over the role of federally owned land, especially in the West. Now, a new report from the nonprofit research group Headwaters Economics looks at whether there's an economic benefit or impediment to non-metro counties with federal land in the West. Megan Lawson is an economist with Headwaters Economics. And Megan, it looks like you found, in general, economic growth was stronger in counties with a lot of federal land than in those without it.
Exactly. Yep, we found that counties with the most federal land have had far greater growth in population, employment, and personal income over the last several decades than in counties with the least federal land.
Can you make the leap and make a correlation that that growth is because of the presence of all that federal land there?
No. That's something I want to be very careful about with interpreting these results. We're not implying that the federal lands are causing this economic growth, but we can safely conclude that they're not impeding economic growth.
What are some of the opportunities with federal land? I mean, in many cases, you can't develop it. There are very stringent restrictions about what you can do on that land. So what are some of the ways that counties and residents in those counties can use those federal lands to drive economic growth?
Well, historic use of a lot of federal lands has been for natural resource extraction, whether that's mining, oil and gas, timber, grazing, and that's certainly still a common use and economic driver in a lot of places. What we see in the counties that have been most successful economically is that they've been able to embrace some more diverse economic activity from those federal lands. So they're capitalizing on those lands as recreation assets, scenic vistas, things that attract visitors. But beyond just tourism, those are amenities that can attract new residents or keep existing residents in the area. And so we can see federal lands really as a community asset that places can leverage to expand the economic diversity of their economies.
Within the results you found of counties that have lots of federal land with stronger economic growth than those that don't, Arizona seems to be a bit of an outlier. Do you have a sense of why that might be?
Yes, and that's a great reminder of another caveat I want to remind folks of with this research, is that this is looking at averages across the West. So there are certainly counties that fall at either end that are outliers and that kind of provide counterexamples. And in Arizona, that's a perfect example. We have Greenlee County, which has very high proportion of federal land and has had relatively low economic performance. And a lot of that, I believe, is being driven by the fact that it's a copper mining community, if I'm not mistaken. And when a community has that sort of long-term reliance on a single sector, we tend to see a lot of volatility because they're subject to the whims of the broader commodity markets.
In Arizona, did you find that the presence of federal land was actually impeding economic growth, or was it just not contributing to potential growth in the counties here?
No, I don't think we can say that it's necessarily impeding it, but when we think about federal lands potentially as an asset, they're maybe not being capitalized upon in a way that might lead to greater economic growth.
Well, do you think that there is a missed opportunity in some of those non-metro counties that have a lot of federal land? I mean, do you think there's potential there that they're just not tapping into?
I think there could be. And again, you know, every county is different, but I do think that there may be some opportunities in a new way of thinking about the role that federal lands can play in local economies that not all communities have considered, you know, especially when you have long-term historic uses of the lands, when they've always been used for one type of activity, it can be an adjustment to start thinking of new types of uses and the potential benefit to communities from those new types of uses.
Megan Lawson is an economist at Headwaters Economics. Megan, thank you very much.
Thank you, Mark.
You're listening to the show on KJZZ, and these are the sounds of the city.
Hi, my name is April Ann, and I'm down here in Mesa, Arizona for the Street Pianos event. Local artists decorated 24 pianos, and they're all over the streets of Mesa, mostly on Main. And anybody can come and play these pianos.
There.
I teach piano by day, so to hear anybody just touching a piano is so fantastic, and it's neat to just walk down the street and just hear all the different random piano sounds that are happening.
You're awesome, Lance.
It's wonderful because it's a great icebreaker. There'll be people eating or just walking, and they'll stop, and all of a sudden, conversations start, relationships start.
That's April Ann playing one of the street pianos in downtown Mesa. The pianos will be there until April 9th. If you have suggestions or hear things that make Phoenix Phoenix, or just think we could use a little bit more practice, send us a note, the show at kjzz.org.
In KJZZ News at 2:35, the U.S. Department of Veterans Affairs will be implementing new initiatives to reduce the rate of veteran suicides. Included are a same-day evaluation goal for urgent mental health needs, early intervention using predictive modeling techniques, and increasing the availability of naloxone kits at VA facilities to prevent opioid overdose deaths. KJZZ reached out to multiple veteran service organizations in the state for their reaction. Most said it's too early to tell if this will have a measurable impact. But Dave Hampton with the Arizona Department of Veterans Services adds,
anything that can be done to reduce veterans' suicides is a step in the right direction.
The announcement follows the VA's recent summit on preventing veteran suicides held in Washington, D.C. last month.
Prescribed burns in the Tonto National Forest have been stalled due to dangerous weather conditions. February was one of the warmest and driest on record. Kerry Templin with Tonto said those were not favorable conditions for firefighters working to decrease the risk for fires.
There's not enough moisture in what we're trying to burn. There's not enough moisture in the ground, and temperatures and winds were just not cooperating with us.
The dry conditions can lead to sparks in the burn piles, which are created during thinning projects in the fall. Templin says those sparks can then move to trees and create bigger problems. The prescribed burns are usually conducted yearly through March. Templin says the burns could resume, but not until the area sees more rain or snow.
In a look at international news, it's quite remarkable how, despite the enormous technological changes made in the past 100 years, radio is still a central part in so many people's lives, even in places like Syria.
Despite 5 years of grueling civil war, independent radio still exists. But just how does a radio station operate and sound in the midst of civil war? The BBC's Chris Vallance has been listening in.
The sound of Walat FM, an independent radio station broadcasting in Qamishli in northeastern Syria. When I look out the window here at the BBC, all I see are offices. But for the editor of Walat FM, the view from the studio window is very different.
All I see is the Syrian military airport. What is really annoying is that you look from the window and you see the airport and you hear the noise of the warplanes every day, every morning, at night, the whole time.
In the past, he's had to flee the Assad regime. Now he promotes freedom of speech through the medium of radio.
I wake up at 6 a.m. in the morning, and even though I am the chief editor, I still do some basic tasks, starting the generator, and turning on the computer and setting up the mixer so everything is ready by 7 a.m. We're running the station from a very simple studio. We have two microphones, a computer and a mixer, a desk and two chairs. It's a primitive studio, but under these conditions, we try to do our best.
Wilat FM is a member of Sirenet, a network of 9 independent radio stations that get together to create a single channel broadcast in Syria. It includes everything from reports on the conflict to children's programs. But in Syria, you can't just set up a large transmission tower anywhere you like, which is why a Berlin-based NGO is helping out. They've created pocket FMs, micro-transmitters the size of breeze blocks, capable of picking up the Sirenet channel via satellite and rebroadcasting it in FM. Although their range is only enough to cover a single town, their small size makes them easier to deploy in those areas where it's safe to broadcast. Najat Abdul-Haq works for the NGO Media in Cooperation and Transition.
There is a space, it might be tiny, but there is a space where people are against Assad and are not part of the Islamic movements.
And you're helping, you're putting, if you like, miniature radio stations into the region.
Exactly. These pocket FMs, these are very small transmitters.
And you're holding it in one hand.
Yes, it's less than 1 kilo. The weight of it is like, I think, 870-something gram.
We try to develop a small box that is easy to carry around, easy to transport, easy to hide, that is based on 12 volts, so you can connect it to a solar system, to your car battery.
Philip Hochleiter designed the Pocket FMs.
And so far the feedback is good. We did not lose any device, it didn't break. We lost one device though in Kobani, but due to the bombing, not due to malfunction.
So far, they've only lost equipment. But as that suggests, broadcasting can be a risky business.
The BBC's Chris Valance.
Downtown Phoenix is changing, and now so is one of its major parks. Hants Park, which runs between 3rd Street and 3rd Avenue over I-10, is going to undergo some major upgrades thanks to a coalition of stakeholders who are making it happen. The first phase of the park's master plan will be unveiled tonight at Artlink Phoenix's annual Art Decor Gala.
We call this the heart of the park.
Chris Floor, Marcia Karasek, and Tim Sprague are walking through the freshly cut grass of Hants Park.
There's the Burton Barr Library, the central library that's on the park. And so right next to that, literally in the center of the park, is where Central goes across the park. And you'll see a bridge that we'll see here. And that bridge will become the center focal point of all activity, connecting the two sides together.
They are all leaders of the Hants Park Conservancy, which has been working on a master plan to recreate the park for the last 5 years, and their plans are grand.
Everybody realizes that what happens here in the park raises all the boats for everybody around it.
The bridge over Central Avenue will become the park's urban plaza, complete with restaurants and retail space, and even a skate park. And the whole thing will be covered by a landmark structure they're calling the cloud.
So one of the key elements of the park design is the cloud. And it is a large structure that will span over the top of light rail and sort of cascade down on both the east and west sides of the park and create a nice shaded plaza.
The conservancy began with the neighborhood when members of the Roosevelt Action Association got together and began planning what they could do with the park. Then the City of Phoenix's Parks and Recreation Department got involved, and the public-private partnership that's funding the project was born. They held 12 public meetings to get community input on the park, and Floor, one of the landscape architects on the project, decided where to begin.
One of the big things we noticed is you can't see the park from any street edge.
She wanted to open it up.
A big focus for us was to open the view into the park from a vehicular standpoint, but then also open the view in from a pedestrian standpoint and do nice, wide, gracious sidewalks that lead down to the plaza level.
Floor envisions the east side of the park as a major event space. It's playing host to the McDowell Mountain Music Festival this weekend. The west side will be more of a neighborhood park where smaller festivals and events like Yoga in the Park can take place.
You watch and look at every major city in the world, and the ones that have had the best urbanization that have been the most successful, and one that there always is a sense of refuge around there, so that folks have the ability to take their shoes off, walk in the grass, relax, go through a frisbee, and also it acts as a very good common gathering space for everybody.
The first phase of the project will focus on Central Avenue to 3rd Street.
There's going to be a skate park involved. There's going to be an amphitheater involved. There's going to be a gathering place where the old fire station there on 1st Street in Moreland will be transformed into a really cool food and beverage location.
That should be completed in the next 3 years, and Tim Sprague says they'd like to finish the entire project within 8, and they believe this is the right time and place. Here's Karasek.
This is the epicenter of most of the cultural organizations of Phoenix. The Art Museum, the Phoenix Theater, the Library, the Phoenix Center for the Arts, Irish Cultural, Japanese, Jewish Heritage. It's all right here, and it's also right next to Roosevelt Row and the real street arts that have activated this area.
Sprague is developing a 149-unit condo project just south of Hans Park called Portland on the Park. He says in 2014, just less than 6,000 people lived within about a half-mile radius of the park, but that's all changing now.
With all of the projects that are under development right now, these are things that are in the ground, not on the drawing board, but in the ground being developed right now, that number will double in the next 24 months.
And to him, bringing that many people to the area means it's time to invest in Hans Park.
Because if you don't have a center like this, where you have a cultural and a real community center, there's no reason to live here. And when you have the core of the park, everything that radiates from it, it's very valuable, and not in terms of social interaction, but also economically.
To make that vision for Hans Park a reality, the Hans Park Conservancy will have to change what's there now. The show's Annika Klein visited a longtime neighbor of the park that will have to move as a result of the new development.
This is streetcar number 116. Built in 1928 and ran until 1948.
Streetcar 116 is the crown jewel of the Phoenix Trolley Museum. It's an almost fully restored red and white streetcar. The museum rescued it in the late 70s after it spent a few decades as a tiny apartment. It was about that time that Ernie Workman came along for the ride as a volunteer.
Now, the other streetcar apparently bounced around. We don't know who all may have purchased it, but it ended up as a concession stand at Legend City.
That other trolley is just a shell of its former self. Most of the wood rotted away during its time as a concession stand and a brief stint as a monkey cage in a petting zoo. Both sit in a metal car barn on Central Avenue and Culver Street, right next to the west side of Hans Park. Workman says the museum leases the property from the city, and they've renewed their lease every 5 years for the past few decades.
I sent in the regular request for a 5-year extension last fall, and instead of the normal email response, I got an email that said, this request has been forwarded to the Phoenix Historic Preservation Department.
This time, the lease was not renewed. The city said in a statement the site will be turned into a skateboard park as part of the new Hans Park plan. Workman says the lease is up in September, unless the city approves a temporary extension of up to 2.5 more years. Either way, the Phoenix Trolley Museum will have to find a new location.
It doesn't make any difference where we go. It's going to be expensive. It's very difficult to assess, but we know it's going to be talking something $1 million plus. Probably $4 to $5 million.
Workman says the museum was already struggling to get enough visitors, which he admits could be partly due to their own outdated marketing. He hopes a silver lining of the move will be to raise more awareness that the museum even exists.
It's always been a challenge, but this is the biggest challenge we've ever had to deal with. And it's unfortunate that in our modern society, preservation of memories of history don't seem to have a strong recognition amongst the population.
From this location, you can hear the light rail pass by on Central, a testament to how far transit has moved forward. The volunteers at the Phoenix Trolley Museum hope to continue to remind us where it came from. It's the show. I'm Annika Klein.
Clang, clang, clang with the trolley. Ding, ding, ding with the bell.
Phoenix has long been synonymous with car culture, and that's evolved significantly as more bus service is added and light rail has proven to be popular. Now Phoenix is one of 7 cities in the U.S. taking part in the program called Ladder Step. It's connected to the light rail extension coming to South Phoenix and is intended to help revitalize the area. Albert Santana, assistant to the Phoenix City manager, is here to talk with me about it. So, Albert, how much of Ladder Step is philosophical? How much is financial?
Well, right now, from a financial perspective, the Ladder Step is more of technical materials that they're providing. It's not a specific dollar amount. As a part of the Department of Transportation, there are other revenue sources that we will be able to pursue from a financial perspective. They have formula grants as well as they do have programs to provide you that funding. But what Ladder Step does is while they provide you assistance with funding for capital, they also have these technical experts that can come into your local jurisdiction, take best practices throughout the country and say, how can we help move your project through the process while we're doing the other items? So it's a really neat element that they've added about kind of more of a philosophical, more of an emotional component and what transportation does while you still have to have the funding to move it forward.
When the word revitalization is brought up, that's usually followed by some by gentrification. How do city leaders balance this idea of saying, we're going to revitalize, but we also want to keep the cultural state, the types of people who've been there for all these generations to sort of give them the boot from their neighborhood?
From a revitalization perspective, and the word does come, you know, that you have people usually ask about gentrification, and then there are also the transit-oriented development. But really what we're trying to do now is that we look at our existing right-of-way and try to figure out how can we work within those lines of our city right-of-way, meaning that for all of those small businesses that are immediately adjacent to our project in those neighborhoods and those schools, we want to make sure that we preserve all of those uses because that's why we're going there, to make sure that those communities have the connectivity. And also what we're doing as specifically in Phoenix that I think is honestly unique throughout the country, through the leadership of our mayor and council, we're actually starting early action light rail business assistance elements, meaning like we are starting to work with those businesses now, working with those schools now, saying, we've made a decision. We are now going to accelerate this project. We want to bring this asset to your community. We want to make sure you're here. Mm-hmm. And even though we're several years before we actually start construction, we want to make you a healthy community, whether you're a business owner, whether you're a school, whether you're a neighborhood association. So we're actually going to be going to council here in the coming months to outline and really put out a scope of how we're going to start an early action assistance program now, specifically in South Phoenix. And this will be replicated for all of our future corridors for light rail in Phoenix. So we're pretty excited about that.
Is there a way to define success? I mean, do you look at it? Can you look at it in two decades and say, hey, we accomplished this? Or can you look at it once the accelerated extension gets started and say, yeah, we're looking for this?
When you make these investments and you start to kind of see your downtown becoming almost like an ecosystem for attracting different groups of people coming here, and that's what really starts to see. So it's not just about measuring how many people are riding it or how many people are not riding it, et cetera. It's a matter of ridership's important, your economic development's important, the investments that's coming here, not just from a public sector, but the private sector interest that's starting to come here. For example, one area, like in downtown Phoenix, the amount of small local businesses that are specifically coming in and telling us as a business owner, the reason why I'm here is because the city in this case made an investment to have a light rail station here, which is helping my business be more successful. So having those types of stories and having a more sustainable economy mm-hmm. versus trying to let out and allow it to be volatile, I think those are the things that really will help us to measure it as this moves forward.
Albert Santana is a transportation specialist who is assistant to the Phoenix City Manager.
It's the show on KJZZ for Thursday, March 10th. Thank you so much for listening. I'm Mark Brody.
And along with the takeaways, Todd Zwillick, I'm Steve Goldstein.
All our Canadian friends, we are two different countries, but days like this remind us that we're like one big town, and we reaffirm that Americans and Canadians will always be there for each other. Welcome to the United States. Bienvenue, mes amis.
In Washington, D.C. today, Pennsylvania Avenue is festooned with maple leaf flags. And at the White House, Northern Coldwater Halibut and Yukon potatoes are on the menu, all because newly elected Canadian Prime Minister Justin Trudeau is in town for a state dinner with the Obamas, the first state dinner for a Canadian Prime Minister in 19 years. That's right, 19 years since these two very best of friends have just sat down together, you know, just caught up. I know how it is. Hey, I lived in Canada for 5 years myself, even went to school with Justin Trudeau. It's just, you know, we never talk anymore. So we thought this would be the perfect time to check in with our northern friends. There are big issues to talk about, oil and war. But hey, when you're this close in a relationship, you can't let the little issues fester either. You gotta talk out the small stuff too. So we have Diane Francis. She's author of Merger of the Century, Why Canada and America Should Become One Country. She's also editor-at-large for the National Post in Canada. She joins me from Toronto. Hi, Diane.
Hello.
19 years. Why so much time since the last state dinner?
Well, the relationship has been as frosty as Canada's climate. I mean, between Bush's Iraq War, which we took a pass on, and the bad relationships that resulted from that, and then Keystone, it's been chilly.
And is it because the new Liberal PM, Justin Trudeau, has been elected that the thaw is possible now?
Well, it is, because I think one of the first phone calls he had with Obama was to be told that Keystone was going to be nixed. And he didn't freak out. He said he was disappointed, but he understood America can do what America wants to do. So he was very gracious, as Canadians always are. And so then the invitation was put in the mail a couple of weeks later.
Just like that. Americans might be less thrilled, however, when they learn that Canada actually withdrew its F-18 fighters from the fight against ISIS, refusing to help us in the bombing in Iraq and Syria anymore.
That's disappointed a number of Canadians as well. We only had 6 jets there. We have a tiny, tiny military. But, you know, they have stepped up and tripled the number of trainers on the ground who are helping the Kurds. So they're doing their bit. That's what they're saying.
But what did the Canadian government give as a reason? I mean, Canada doesn't involve itself militarily in all U.S. operations, but they were involved in this one and then pulled back.
Well, you know, it's a different prime minister, a different attitude toward the threat in the Middle East. This guy is a much more peacenik type prime minister who doesn't see that it's as much of a problem, and he's not, you know, as militaristic as the other fellow was.
But what happens to American and Canadian relations when the price of oil is this low, $40 a barrel? I mean, we trade a great deal of petroleum with Canada, take a lot of crude from Canadian oil fields, and it's just not worth anything right now.
No, it isn't, and that's very sad. And the oil sands has been rejected because of the Keystone rejection. So all of that is a very big concern, because a big underpinning for our economy is oil. And since oil is priced, you know, the oil price has collapsed, our dollar has gone down with it, actually in tandem, because it's known as a petrocurrency. So the Canadian dollar, which was, you know, mightily trading at par with the U.S. dollar only 3 years ago, is now in the 60s. It's pretty disastrous if you want to take a vacation in Florida, which a lot of Canadians do.
Well, there's big money at stake there. But Diane Francis, you know, when two countries are as close as ours, there are always lots of little issues boiling below the surface that we have to discuss. What's going on with milk, with dairy? I know that this is a longstanding bit of contention between Canada and the U.S.
Well, we do our dairy sector and our poultry sector differently than free trade would like it, and than the Americans would like it. So we have a closed shop. We have a closed shop for dairy and eggs and chickens and turkeys, and we don't let Americans export into our market, nor do we export into yours, to be fair. So we all pay a little bit more for that stuff so we can keep a few farmers employed. It's a very controversial farming sector, and it's a constant irritant with the Americans. There's other things, too. We can't sell softwood lumber to the extent we want to in your country, and we can't sell beef and pork sometimes. So these are the things that, you know, bug the two countries and the irritants that are ongoing. But, you know, it's not like Macedonia and Greece.
It's not like Macedonia and Greece, but still a bit of protectionism between the two sides. I want you to listen to Stephen Kelly. He's a professor at Duke University. I spoke to him back over the summer about a land dispute at Machias Seal Island off the coast of Maine.
There was a report out of one of the Canadian news magazines that suggested that war was imminent. It's not that bad, but there is definitely a feeling that there's a new element in the fishery this summer.
Diane Francis, Justin Trudeau and President Obama are going to have to get serious about this bona fide land dispute at Machias Seal Island off of New Brunswick.
Yeah, I think they should have a boxing match. I mean, this is so picayune. To even distinguish it by calling it a war would be... You know, a lot of Canadians don't even know about this. And, you know, the waters are tricky, because if it's offshore, you have a 200-mile or 200-kilometer limit. And, you know, where does the line get drawn? There's a big dispute, a much bigger dispute in the Beaufort Sea between Alaska and Canada over oil fields around Prudhoe and stuff like that because of the same issue. So these are the things that go on. But, you know, it's a pretty good relationship.
Yeah, no, all of this stuff may disappear in importance when the massive migration wave comes of all the Americans who swear they're leaving for Canada if Donald Trump is elected president, or alternatively, probably if Hillary Clinton is elected president. I hope you're ready.
Well, just a minute. This is 34 million people up here, and we're all Democrats. I'm a conservative in the Canadian political scene, but that puts me left to the Democrats. I like our universal health care system, and I like a lot of the social democratic traditions that we have here, and so does Bernie Sanders. Clinton is moving toward Bernie, and so, you know, we're all kind of getting in sync.
Well, then there's no doubt that there's a lot for Prime Minister Justin Trudeau and President Obama to chew over during their state dinner and in the Oval Office. Diane Francis, author of Merger of the Century, Why Canada and America Should Become One Country. Thanks so much.
You're welcome.
That's Todd Zwillick, our partner to the North and East at The Takeaway.
Oh, so that's our topic for today, the Great White North. So good day.
What an education, eh?
That's the show for today. This has been a KJZZ original production from Phoenix. You can find photos, audio segments, and more information about the program at theshow.kjzz.org. I'm Steve Goldstein. Thanks for listening to the show podcast.